This trout comes to us from Roscoe, New York, which our local anglers like to refer to as Trout Town, USA. Now, to our frittata. We're going to let this go for another minute.
As for the food, one word, vomited.
Vomited?
Another scathing review, how right.
Public demands for all meat, I just give it to them.
What the hell is going on? Where is everybody?
Feast.
Reviewed by Jamie Frank.
Gordon, he's a food blogger.
You just don't get it. This is a disaster.
So what now?
The sous chef from Marlowe & Sons is going to be in this afternoon. He's taking over the kitchen.
I'm fired?
Good morning, Mr. Franks.
Mr. Gray!
Do you know him? Jason Franks. Hey, he wrote a nasty review of your restaurant.
Am I a person of interest, Mr. Coley?
But I feel we're quite close to it.
You guys had an exciting premiere last night, didn't you? Your world premiere?
Yeah, it was really great. We had a great crowd, and people seemed to really enjoy it. It was a fun ride.
Larry, tell me how crucial a film festival is for an independent film. Today.
Oh, it's really it's the essential ingredient. Once you've made the film, to present it to an audience, it's the first time you get a couple of reviews and some notices. And honestly, just to bid the festival is a great affirmation, especially a festival like LAFF, because they obviously have a lot of submissions and the whole thing. So it's really a first major step towards getting distribution and also getting a sense of what the film is to an outsider.
Yeah.
And there are people. It's been really valuable reading, the comments about what it is, and then you feel you get a sense of how it's going over.
Joe, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I am.
I was just asking about the premiere, the world premiere last night, yesterday. How was that experience for you, kind of giving birth to it to an audience for the first time?
It was great. I think it was a great theater, and I wasn't sure how the audience would receive it, not in whether they would like it or not, but there's been for me some uncertainty about, is this really a horror film? Some people are referring to it as comedic. I mean, it was like a thriller, and so it was interesting. I have to say I've been bucking at the comedic label, but people were laughing quite a bit, so I don't know. So interesting, but I was glad people seemed to really enjoy it with it. I heard some gasps at the right moments, and people were laughing, so I think we were successful in keeping them entertained, so I was very happy.
Well, if you could tell me, first of all, the inspiration for the movie, and then I want to get into the production and putting it all together. I understand the inspiration has something to do with Gordon Ramsay and a criticism of one of his restaurants.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, it was two things. Larry called and was sort of, didn't say, hey, do you want to make a movie? He said, do you have any horror scripts, that you would be interested in doing on a low budget? And I was like, oh, not really. But, I didn't want to I felt like he was going to ask me if I wanted to do something, so I didn't want to pass up the opportunity. So that review popped into my head, which is something I'd read a couple years earlier and had taken some notes on. And essentially it was a review in the New York Times of Gordon Ramsay's London Hotel, which was his first restaurant ever in, I think, in the United States, certainly in New York. And I'm a big fan of Frank Bruni normally, but this review I thought was really kind of lazy, and you know, he didn't seem to have anything against the food, but he said that he felt the restaurant itself lacked excitement, you know, and that's pretty damaging coming from Frank Bruni in the New York Times. And I thought, God, it's such a, what a silly thing to say, and you know, it's going to hurt Gordon Ramsay. And I thought, boy, you know, Gordon Ramsay seems like, I mean, I don't know the guy, but he seems really kind of psychotic on TV. I started thinking, like, you know, what would he do if he ever got his hands on Frank Bruni? And, you know, started imagining things that would happen. And I just started thinking more and more about it. And I thought, you know, what he would probably want is, you know, is to somehow make Frank Bruni feel that vulnerable, you know what I mean, to feel what it's like to really care about something, to invest all his time and energy in it, and then have someone just completely destroy it arbitrarily and randomly, and that's sort of what was the genesis for the idea. So then when Larry called, I said, yeah, and I sort of whipped that up, and then it was, I think, a little bit too arty at first, not enough to spend stuff, and then Larry and Brent and Pete all, you know, we all kind of, over the course of the next couple of months, you know, whipped it into shape, I think, and came up with a lot of good ideas. So, so that was basically it.
So Brent, tell me about that process. When you first hear the idea in the screenplay, Joe's working on the screenplay, what kind of suggestions did you guys have about finding a tone for it? Because it seems like a hybrid. I mean, Joe was just saying he didn't really know if it was going to play more horror, more comedy, more thriller. So what was finding that balance like, that process?
Well, it's great. I mean, well, first of all, Joe is incredibly difficult to work with. I mean, I don't know
quite, you've got all of us on this phone together. We're not speaking to each other.
No, actually, quite contrary. So, I mean, as far as just working with Joe and you know, suggestions and popping around ideas and stuff, I mean, it couldn't have gone smoother. I mean, he was totally receptive. And of course, as he should, when things kind of, we'd make suggestions that he wasn't quite in tune with, he'd let us know that, and, you know, we'd move on. So that all was very, very smooth, and I think it kind of formed from, it was a little bit of a triangle drama at the beginning, and we kind of wanted to skew it more towards the dynamic between these two guys, the blogger and the chef, and you know, so we really there's a few you know, once people see the movie, there's a few food challenges that the chef makes the blogger go through, and we really tried to get in tune with those moments, and you know, as a way to sculpt the movie and kind of their dynamic throughout. So you know, we
it was interesting
kind of,
because it actually, Joe had the idea of these food challenges, but I feel like we were so turned on by that element that I think we encouraged Joe to do another one. Isn't that how it worked, Brent? Because they were so great. It's funny when the artist is onto something but doesn't isn't getting all the juice out of it. So I think that was the main note we had.
Yeah, I think there was one challenge, and then you guys felt like it could become almost
the real,
like,
fun
fine,
stuff. Yeah.
It's fine, yeah. And then someone, I don't know who, someone had the idea that he would actually read past reviews of from J.D. Franks and let him sort of hang himself with his own, like, being forced now to listen to his own snarky, nasty reviews. That seemed to get
oh,
back
that's
out
funny
a lot of laughs.
That's so integral. I didn't realize anybody. I thought that was your idea, Joe. See,
I don't know.
You
definitely
showed me into thinking this was all your work. Anyway, that is my favorite element. I think these reviews that Joe has written as J.T. Franks are just so delicious and nasty and witty, and I think that's the source of the humor, and I think that's what's fun about the movie, is that this humor is it's just very witty in a kind of way we don't see in a lot of movies, where it's really derived from the writing, and that's such a pleasure in the film. And of course, James LeGros is just delicious, the way he's such a hurt, angry creature, so vengeful and so, but hurt. You know, you can see inside that this is all from, and of course Joe's created this whole backstory that gives the movie some additional weight and a kind of a pathos and a melancholy, which is that the, he had a very troubled relationship with his brother. So all of these elements, I think, really infuse the film with a kind of a more Shakespearean tragic quality.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that is something that, that Larry, you look for, because I know you guys produce a lot through Glass Eye Picks, and I know that you were looking for a horror genre film when you approached Joe. I think I'm right about that. But are you always looking for something that kind of makes it unique, has a unique stamp on it, so it's not strictly a general genre film?
Yeah, I mean, look, if somebody came with the most traditional zombie movie, that would be of interest. But, you know, it has to come from another place. It has to reference the real world and not just the world of film and the world, if you will, of genre. I mean, I'm so drawn to films that speak of the real, you know, the real vulnerability of people, the real hurt that bubbles into violence. You know, trying to understand where this stuff all comes from, and just bring a genuineness to the horror genre. I mean, we love horror. We certainly make other movies, and it's funny. I know Joe always says that one of the films that influenced this movie is All the President's Men, and that's just typical at Glass Eye, where we actually are, all of us, inspired by other types of movies. And and if you bring that sensibility to the genre, you're going to get something fresh, because you're concerned not just with the imagery and tropes that are so familiar, and the gore and the violence and all the things that, you know, define horror nowadays, but in fact you're getting at something much richer, which is you know, the human experience and where it shatters and breaks and turns to violence.
Yeah.
And dread, you know, I really favor dread in my own work. Another emotion that I'm very familiar with.
Do you find, though, that the horror genre kind of comes in waves? There are different kind of revolutions in horror. Do you find that the genre today has a different voice than it did, say, in the 80s or the 90s?
Without a doubt. I always like to point out that horror is an expression of the national anxiety. You know, we had giant bugs in the 50s and Godzilla and huge overblown creatures that all derived from our anxieties over the atomic bomb. A movie like The Invasion of the Body Snatchers was sort of about the, you know, the potential communist takeover and so on. And obviously Frankenstein, these movies were about when the troops were coming back from World War One. People were deformed and there was just a general anxiety in the culture. Well, ironically, we had torture porn during the Bush years, and that and, you know, I think that really does speak. I think historically you'll look back and you go, well, isn't that interesting that the culture just seemed to become totally depraved, and and what our anxieties were is that. Now, I don't know how to explain remakes, except that it probably suggests that we've literally run out of ideas, which may be another statement about the culture.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Invasion of the Body Snatchers, because that, for me, it's amazing how pliable that theme is. It can be applied to every generation. It's been remade several times, and they're all good films that speak to what we're going through in the culture.
Absolutely, and I think that's where horror is doing its best work. And I think with Joe's, it's a more intimate film, so it's also, you know, a perennial idea, two egos just in a clash. I always reference two movies that aren't even in print anymore, Sleuth and Death Trap. Sleuth was with Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier, and it's just two guys, and they're just going at each other in this huge country estate, and it really is very similar in my mind. I don't know, Joe, if you've even seen it.
I have never seen it. I'm embarrassed to say, but I will.
Well, so. Nobody has, but it was a great movie when I was little, in the 70s, I think it came out, and I think you'd get a chuckle out of it. It's very similar in terms of these two guys going at it.
It is a great film. Another film that's been remade.
Michael Caine playing the Olivier part, which
right,
is awesome.
Right, right. Yeah. Peter, crystallize for me what a producer does, how you shepherd a project into reality.
Producers, the title goes out, and it encompasses everything. I mean, there's no, one-set definition that will say, here are the duties. Your job is to kind of take the project beginning to end, kind of no matter what it takes. At the end of the day, if it's not done, you got to do it. So, for this, we got the project, and we all kind of sat around and, kind of divvy up tasks of what we were going to do. And, once the script was getting on the way, the next thing we think about is casting. That's, the most immediate, thing, because that will then dictate our schedule. And then we start talking about DPs and formats and what we're going to shoot on. It's, practical kind of sense. And we know this is a low-budget thing, so we don't have a luxury of a lot of time in production. So we really have to prep. And prep everyone, and with the independent film, we try to bring on people who are always going to be excited about the project. There's no sense in bringing anyone in, who's not going to be behind it. And Joe is so great to work with, and everyone that came on board just really responded well to the material and to what we were doing. And then after production, then we move it to post, and that's a little bit more calmer period, and we start seeing the films, shape together, and we all come together and, share our notes, and then kind of really guide the film to, its final destination. And then even then, we still feel like the film, it's never really done, because there's always, directions we can go with it. But, at the end of the day, we're all happy, and we like it. It's a big supportive process.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, there's the promotion. You have to continue to, we're all here at the festival because we want to support the film and we want to see how the reviews come out and how the audience enjoys it, and also put on a face to the film so audiences and the professionals understand that it's, that it has our ongoing affection and attention. One thing I was going to say about Pete is, we shot in this camera that does 30 frames per second, and Joe and just the general conversation became about how you have, if it had a 24 frame per second look, it might be better, and then you just get into these things where you really want to deliver what the director has in mind, and that becomes, a lot of technical things.
Yeah.
Jeff Anderson, who's Joe's editor, they worked very hard to make this technical transformation, and it really helped give the film this cinematic look. And it's just those sort of sticking with it, constantly trying to solve problems, and just keep helping the film where you can.
Well, Joe, tell me about that, achieving that cinematic look, because Larry mentioned it, that a major inspiration for you on this project was All the President's Men. Explain what that connection is.
Well, we knew that we were, Michael McDonough and I, when we got together, Michael was the DP, that there wasn't, we knew we were dealing with a lot of nighttime exteriors in the woods, like deep in the woods, nowhere near a power supply, was going to cost an extraordinary amount of money to try and light that in any way. And so Michael had recently purchased one of these 5Ds, and he thought, he said this was the camera to do it. It can see what the human eye sees, how he put it. And so we did a lot of tests and looked at a lot of movies. And one of the movies that Michael showed me was All the President's Men, which I'd seen, but, I'd seen years ago and was looking at, watched it more just for entertainment. I wasn't actually studying it. And we were amazed at how dark it was. I mean, physically dark, not thematically dark. Thematically dark as well. But Gordon Willis, the joke on the set was that Gordon Willis is, not afraid of the dark.
He's the Prince of Darkness. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the Prince of Darkness. We that was sort of our mantra. We wanted to really play with that kind of, outrageous darkness, and also just sort of obscuring the action in the frame. I mean, there's a lot of times where we're just, the action is occurring in one little sliver of frame, not being afraid to use that kind of, throw things into the foreground. And so in that regard, we really we watched that movie a lot, and it actually just sort of steeled our reserve to really push the, you know, push ourselves aesthetically as far as we can. At the end of every day, you know, we would be sitting there having a martini or a cocktail or something, and I would ask Michael, you know, do you think we went far enough today? And he would assure me that we had. So that was really, that was what that was about.
Well, you have a great cast assembled here in, you know, your two leads, James LaGrosse and Joshua Leonard. Tell me about that process, what you saw in them that they could bring to the character, and how they kind of exceeded your vision of these characters when you saw them bring them to life.
Well, it's funny. James LaGrosse I'd seen in The Last Winter, and I thought he was fantastic. And I'd actually plays a very different character in that movie than he does in Bitter Feast. And I'd actually thought that that's who I wanted. I wanted that character and, you know, more of a rugged, sexual, a more well-balanced person, I guess. Although in The Last Winter, he does sort of lose his mind, but at least in the beginning of The Last Winter, kind of a rugged, you know, got the beard, out hunting, man's man. And so, you know, I told Larry, do you think he would be willing to do it? And Larry called, and then we never heard back from him. He's not interested, you know what I mean? So we started looking around and trying to figure out what we were going to do, and then Larry called again, you know, sort of on a whim, and James picked up. He'd never even gotten the message, and he agreed to do it right there, and so we were all thrilled. That really, for me at least, that really, I felt like the movie was going to happen. As soon as, you know, when we got James, I was like, all right, that's it. You know, we've got our cast, and Joshua came through. I'd seen Hump Day, and I thought, you know, we thought Mark Duplass or Joshua. We called Mark Duplass. He was working on Cyrus, but recommended Joshua. So we called him. He read the script and, you know, came on board. So it was relatively painless in that regard. And James, I'd been a fan of James ever since, you know, Drugstore Cowboy, yeah. Living in Oblivion, and when he showed up, I was astonished. He was off book, and there's a lot of dialogue. I mean, there is a lot of dialogue. He had it. I mean, he knew his lines, every line, and he had created this character that was very different than what I'd envisioned. But when I saw it, you know, I thought, all right, this it works. I'm very happy with this. So that was really, you know, the sort of the fastidious, he's a very fastidious, you know, meticulous, you know, mercurial character, and that was all James. And then I sort of took that and ran with it. So with Joshua we talked a lot more. I think Joshua's more of a method-y kind of guy. You know, we talked a lot about the character and backstory and what was going on, had a lot of conversations, and we sort of came up with, you know, who J.T. Franks was together. And it was interesting because Joshua likes to just throw the lines away sometimes and improvise. And there was James who, you know, had, you know, so much dialogue and is much more, I think, of a classical kind of, you know, actor, takes an approach to his craft. You know, he shows up, he's prepared. And I think we were able to use, I think it kind of annoyed James a little bit, although he and Joshua got along, you know, fantastically. And it worked. I think it kind of tweaked James a little bit when Joshua would sort of throw the dialogue away and say something that wasn't supposed to be said. I think it added a level of tension that was not anticipated, but that was very welcome. So
yeah. So when you look at the movie now, thinking back on the vision that you had when you wrote it, how much of that vision survived, do you think? Because in production, I'm sure there are lots of compromises, and hopefully all those compromises are creative or handled very creatively for the betterment of the film. But Does it match or exceed what you had in your mind when you started?
I have to be honest with you. I can never remember what I had envisioned beforehand. This is all it ever was for me at this point. You know, I've tried to do that. Occasionally, I'll get flashes of something if I see an old draft of a script or something. But it's like that little amnesia thing in Men in Black. You know, like I've now forgotten completely what I was thinking before we went into production. It was always going to be James. It was always Joshua. You know, and I'm thrilled with the way it looks. You know, this was the first time for me that I ever had a crew of people, where I ever had, you know, a production designer, where I ever had a costume design. You know, people actually really creating this universe and bringing their own vision and talents to it. You know, Brian Spears and doing all the effects, the flood effects, and all that stuff. So it's far surpassed anything that I could have ever imagined. You know, that it would be, especially on our budget. I mean, it's just extraordinary, I think. So.
Yeah. Brent, tell me what's upcoming for you guys. Any future projects on the plate?
Yeah, well, we're in post-production, a lot of post-production. The Bitter Feast was the first of actually a slate of three films that we got involved with a company called MPI Media, and also, you know, they have their film outlet called Dark Sky Films. So there's two other movies there, Stakeland by Jim Mickle, who did a movie called Mulberry Street, and also a creature feature called Hypothermia, which we shot on a frozen lake in upstate New York this past February. So just kind of shepherding those projects through post-production. And then Larry and Pete had just wrapped up on The Innkeepers, Ty West's latest installment. You know, and then Jason, money to make more movies. So hopefully we can keep doing it. I don't know how flush people are feeling these days, but you know, one thing we will do is, you know, as much as we want to, you know, just go out and make movies, we want to also stick to our guns and make sure the projects feel right and get going. So we'll see.
Yeah. So
we're also
Larry,
while we're waiting around, we're making a radio program, which we're very excited about. In fact, Joe is contributing an episode, and I always like to say, if you can't tell stories with you know, cameras and light, let's tell stories in the dark with sound, and so this will be a nice sidebar for us while we search for another movie to make.
I think, Larry, you're in a wind tunnel or something.
I am. I'll let someone else speak.
No, that's fine. What are your hopes for Bitter Feast? Where do you want it to go from here?
We have a festival run coming up. We're going to be in Woodstock, and we're waiting to hear from a few others. And then we're going to talk with Dark Sky about a release pattern that works for them.